Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
And welcome to the podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel with the New Books Network. This is your co-host, Shahnaz Afani. Today, our conversation is with Alyssa Gabay on her wonderful new book, Gender and Succession in Medieval and Early Modern Islam, Bilateral Descent and the Legacy of Fatima, published in 2020 with IB Torres. Gabay is an associate professor and director of undergraduate studies at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Her areas of interest include Indo-Persian culture, Shiaism, gender and Islam, religious pluralism, among others. Her recent book, Gender and Succession in Medieval and Early Modern Islam, the subject of today's conversation, shows that contrary to assumptions about Islam's patrilineal nature, there is in fact precedent in pre-modern Islamic history of Muslims' recognition of bilateral descent or descent from both the mother and the father. Though, of course, bilateral descent was by no means universally acknowledged. Although not the only example of this argument, Muhammad's daughter Fatima is essential to the study because of her status in both Sunni and Shia societies historically, as well as because especially Shiais, but not only Shiais, have used the example of Fatima, through whom Muhammad's lineage can be traced, to argue in support of bilateral descent. In our conversation, we discussed the concept of bilateral descent and its three components of women as mothers, heiresses, which I have a hard time pronouncing, but it is the feminine plural of the word heir, and successors, Fatima's relevance and significance to the discussion of descent, and as a representative of bilateral descent, parallels between Mary, the mother of Jesus, and other pious women in Muslim history, Fatima's claim to Fadak as her inheritance and its impact on Sunni and Shiite history, and female rulers in Muslim history. The book would make for an enjoyable and educational read for anyone interested in gender studies, Islam and gender, female authority, biographical studies, medieval Islam, and Islamic history, and would make for a great resource for both undergraduate and graduate Islam courses. I enjoyed my conversation with Alyssa greatly, and I hope that you all will too. Hi, Alyssa. Thank you so much for being here with me and talking about your book, Gender and Succession in Medieval and Early Modern Islam, Bilateral Descent and the Legacy of Fatima. I enjoyed the book so much, and I'm so excited to talk to you about it. We're just talking about how I'm kind of obsessed with Fatima. It's a recent obsession. I really got so much out of this book, and I look forward to our conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And now you know what it's like to be obsessed with Fatima.
So it's our tradition on the New Books podcast to ask our guests to introduce themselves and share their intellectual journey with us. What led you to the field and especially to writing this book?
So I got into Islamic studies in a rather roundabout way. So my father was Iranian. He was of Baha'i and Jewish ancestry. And so I was always kind of around Iranian relatives and Iranian culture when I was growing up. But I didn't have a strong sense of Iranian identity, and I wasn't really encouraged to have one. But it was in my 30s that I developed a real interest in knowing more about Iranian history and culture. And this was very personal. So I wanted to know why my grandparents had gotten divorced in Iran when my grandmother was only 20. And so I wanted to interview my grandmother, who was still alive, living in Alexandria, Virginia. And so I started to learn Persian to be able to interview her. And studying Persian made me fall in love with Persian literature. And that took me kind of naturally into the study of Islam. So I ended up getting my PhD from the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations at the University of Chicago. So I got my PhD in classical Persian literature. But even though that was my primary focus, I studied early and medieval Islamic history and Islamic civilization. I don't know if that's a term that we use anymore, but that's what it was called when I was there, and so on. And these areas of study weren't ever really separated. And I'm really I'm grateful for that. I think studying just classical Persian literature on its own, as great as that would have been it's a much richer experience to study it alongside history, for example. So, for example, I spent a lot of time reading classical Persian texts with my advisor, Heshmat Moayyad. He was a professor of classical Persian literature for many years at the University of Chicago. And I was really lucky to work with him. And I wasn't a traditional grad student. I was in my 30s, but he accepted me nonetheless. He kind of took me under his wing. And in some ways, it was really kind of an old-fashioned relationship between, you know, the peer and the murid, you know, the mentor and the mentee. He was he kind of felt responsible for forming me, and I was kind of ready to be formed. He was really a traditionalist in the sense of his great love for Persian literature and his feeling that students should get a very solid grounding in the classics. So a lot of our classes really consisted of, you know, three or four students sitting around the table in his office and just translating a difficult text, something like Jami or Rumi, and, you know, so very, very close reading and translation. So that was an incredibly rigorous and difficult experience, but a really rewarding one. But at the same time, I was taking medieval history classes with Professor John Woods. And this was a really, you know, again, a really good kind of counterpart to this or counterpoint to this kind of more detailed work that I was doing with Professor Moayyad. So we would look at really broad themes and movements like the Ayan Amir dynamic or confessional ambiguity or the rise of Persianate culture. And so it was a very, again, a kind of very rich experience. And one thing I'm grateful for is that, you know, I didn't enter into the study of Islam or get an education that was really Arabia or Arabic focused. Definitely the importance of Arabia and Arabic were emphasized, but we were really coming at Islam from the edges. And I liked doing that. I think it was very productive. So in terms of how I got into writing this book, my first book was about Amir Khosrow, who was a 13th century Indian poet. And I was writing about this new culture that he helped to create and to propagate through his literature, Indo-Persian culture, which really kind of blended Indic and Persianate mores. And I was especially looking at how he examined and reversed hierarchies that were very much entrenched in Islamic civilization. So he's very, you know, very aware of these hierarchies that exist, but he's very playful with them. So things like scholar, poet, Arabic, Persian, or even man, woman, right? So he's constantly playing with them and inverting them. And it's a very kind of radical and generative act. And gender was definitely part of this. I have a whole chapter on his treatment of gender issues, looking at a particular story from his poem Hash Behesht. And this question of gender was something that really kind of grabbed me. And I decided to pursue it even more deeply in my next book. So the way that I got started on the second book, I was researching my dissertation on Amir Khosrow in India, and I was spending some time at Aligarh University. And I was looking at various manuscripts of divans by Amir Khosrow, and I came across a poem that really startled me. And, you know, Amir Khosrow, as I said, he's all about inverting hierarchy, so maybe I shouldn't have been so surprised, but nevertheless I was, because in it he's speaking about daughters, and he's saying that daughters are actually better than sons, and that you should prefer your grandchildren from a daughter above grandchildren born from a son, because the prophet's grandsons were born from his daughter, right? And then he gets into these Aristotelian ideas about how a daughter contributes blood to the making of a child, whereas a son only contributes water, that is semen, and blood is thicker than water, so the connection is stronger. But he's definitely, you know, identifying the children of a daughter as part of his lineage. And this really, the whole view ran so sort of contrary to the stereotypical views about daughters in medieval Muslim society. So I was very much struck by it. And I was like, you know, what's going on here? And so that really sort of set me out on a journey to find answers, and it led me into an exploration of bilateral descent in medieval Muslim societies, which is what the present book explores. But I really had to to set it aside for many years while I was finishing the first book and getting settled in my career and things like that.
Footnotes and bibliography and your resources, the sources that you use were just are really rich and diverse. I really appreciated that as well. So you can see sort of an element of your previous research in here, and I appreciated that too. So, of course, the focus of the book, the focus on the bilateral descent in the book is on Muslim-majority countries, but what does bilateral descent mean, and what are its alternatives?
Yeah, so when I'm talking about bilateral descent, so a bilateral society is a society that traces descent through both male and female lines. So traditionally, in extremely patrilineal societies, and I don't know that anything this extreme has ever existed, but if we're talking about like the very extreme vision of patrilineality, descent is traced only through men. So if a man has a son and a daughter, his lineage will only be carried on through the son and the son's children. So if the daughter marries someone and has children, they will be accounted part of her husband's lineage, not hers. And so she's really considered a dead end for her birth family's lineage, right? She's a vessel or a receptacle for her husband's lineage. And this is really kind of encapsulated in an Arabic saying that I came across over and over again in my research. And I think it's actually pre-Islamic, but you know, Muslims quote it, and it says, "Our sons are the sons of our sons, but the sons of our daughters are the sons of distant men." So if I'm a man, my son's sons are my sons, but my daughter's sons are the sons, are her husband's sons. So that's kind of patrilineality. But in bilateral societies, the offspring of both daughters and sons are seen as belonging to both parents' families of birth, to their lineages. And of course, if we're talking about matrilineal, then, you know, they belong to the mother's side, right? And I didn't come across that so often. But anyway, bilateral descent is very significant, or lineage. These sort of conceptions of lineage are so significant. They have, you know, implications for inheritance, for succession, for custody, and for the status of women overall.
So, are there any parts of the world where bilateral descent is a norm today? And if so, what does that look like? And I'm especially wondering in the case of lineage as determined through, say, last name choices for children.
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question. And I know that in Spain, people do take on both their father's and their mother's last names. There are probably other examples of this, but that's the only, you know, that's the first example that really comes to me. we see, I mean, you can think of the United States as a fairly bilateral society. I mean, certainly if we look at things like custody and inheritance and citizenship and nationality, those are all pretty bilateral here. But if you think about it, children or most women still do, you know, take their husband's names when they get married. And most children still take their father's names. They have their father's name. So that's still a patrilineal, a vestige of patrilineality that continues in this country. You know, I mean, even countries that are supposedly very progressive still have all of these vestiges of patrilineality. You know, Great Britain, there's still inheritance laws that really favor sons. The succession laws for the royalty in Great Britain were only recently changed to make things more egalitarian between male and female children. I think that there are some countries that are, you know, that are pretty bilateral, but I don't know of any that are completely bilateral. And I'm sure that there are some out there that are matrilineal that I'm unaware of, and that somebody can call in or comment and let me know about that. But that wasn't the focus of my study. So it's possible that that's out there as well.
I believe Mexico and some other Latin American and South American countries also have this idea of the both the mother's and the father's last name being passed on to children.
Yeah.
But of course, at some point, you're going to have to choose, you know, somebody's one parent's last name, and that ends up being the father's last name.
Right. Unless they just go around. I mean, here we have hyphenates, so, you know, maybe they continue to go with that. I don't know.
Yeah. So I meant to ask also if you could tell us about this book, the research and writing process, your methodology, some of your primary findings, what you see as its main interventions, or just anything about the book that you would like our readers to know before we get into the meat.
Okay, sure. So basically, the book examines cases of bilateral dissent in medieval and early modern Islamic societies. And at first I was examining this issue in the context of classical Persian literature, given my training, but I saw relatively soon that I was going to have to go beyond those bounds in order to answer my research questions. And that led me into a much more interdisciplinary approach, which was framed mostly by gender studies. So the book is really trying to answer the question, how was dissent conceived of by medieval and early modern Muslims? To whom did your children belong? What's the nature of the relationship of different family members to each other? And it's a question with so many facets. It's a biological question. It's a legal question. It's an economic question. So to answer it, I cast a very wide net, as you noted earlier. So I look at scientific treatises. I look at hadith collections, Quran commentary, poetry, historical chronicles, endowment deeds, biographical dictionaries. So I'm really trying to say, in a broad sense, how did people conceive of this idea? And really kind of focusing in on examples of bilateralism. Now, some studies have come out and said quite baldly that Islam is a patrilineal religion and that all Islamic societies are patrilineal. But that statement really doesn't hold up, you know, given the evidence. So my main finding or contribution was that that even though pre-modern Islamic societies were typically patrilineal, maybe mostly patrilineal, some showed very distinct bilateral tendencies. And this comes out over a very wide geographical and chronological range, right? It's not confined to Sunni or Shi'i societies. It's not confined to a certain time period or region. And it manifests in how people talked about children. It manifests in inheritance practices, succession patterns, and particularly among the elite. Now, people have in the past done very specific studies kind of looking at different aspects of bilateralism. So inheritance, say, in, you know, the Timurid dynasty or the Safavid dynasty or the Karakoyunlu. And these are really valuable. You know, I drew a lot of this research in my book, but they don't take a step back and look at the bigger picture, which is, trying to put together these pieces of the puzzle to see what this tells us. So I think that's one big area of my kind of intervention or contribution. And the second big area is in how the book looks at Fatima, the daughter of the prophet. So I mentioned earlier that Amir Khosrow uses her as proof for saying that daughters are better than sons. So in this poem, you know, he says, you know, prefer daughters over sons because, or prefer the children of daughters over the children of sons because the prophet's grandsons were through his daughter. So Fatima is really this sort of model for bilateral descent in Islam, even though, of course, you know, scholars aren't calling her that, but this is essentially what she is. And I show how she was depicted in that light in Hadith literature and elsewhere, and also what its impact was for both Sunnis and Shiis. Now, again, there are many, many studies of Fatima, and there are studies of how she appears in Shi'i Hadith literature. And some of these have looked at how she was regarded as someone who transmitted the prophetic bloodline and how this was coupled with an exalted status for her. So some works have looked at this question, but this aspect is often not highlighted. It's not examined thoroughly. It's just kind of, you know, mentioned here and there. But to me, it's so central to an understanding of Fatima and her status that I play it up much more. And just one more thing, also frequently in contemporary scholarship, Fatima isn't really seen as a feminist icon, right? This is changing, but traditionally she's been regarded as sort of a vessel or sort of an emblem of purity and subservience who acts more as a hindrance to women than someone who can actually be helpful to them. So she's someone that they're kind of continually measured against and falling short of. And she's not really seen too much as an agent or as an activist. So the image of Fatima as an agentic woman who is a feminist icon or who can be one is one that I've tried to excavate. So that's one more thing, looking at Fatima from a feminist perspective through the lens of bilateralism in a way that she hasn't been looked at thoroughly before.
So the book focuses on three aspects of bilateral descent, right? Which are mothers, heiresses, and successors. So can you unpack for us these particular aspects and perhaps address also how each contributes to potential consequences for the status of women?
Sure. So I do want to say I have separated these out in the book, but they're very much overlapping and one really kind of grows out of the other. So, you know, even though they're, I'll talk about them separately, they really do kind of, there's a lot of interlinking that goes on there. So in some ways, this first notion, that of motherhood is sort of the most basic concept of bilateral descent. And it really is the kind of radical notion that children belong to both their mothers and their fathers and to both lineages, and that both mothers and fathers contribute significantly to the making of a child. And this may seem really obvious to us today, but it was by no means completely accepted in pre-modern times, whether we're talking about Muslim or non-Muslim societies. So a lot of early Greek thinkers and Muslim thinkers following them argued that women didn't contribute very much to the making of a child. You have the notion that women contribute passive material, the sort of raw material, the blood, which the male semen, which is the carrier of the soul, shapes into a new individual. So if all goes well, the father is imprinting the child with his identity. The woman is just giving raw material, providing a vessel for the fetus. She's not contributing a soul. She's not imprinting the child with her identity. And we certainly see this in this saying that I've already quoted, our sons are the sons of our sons, but the sons of our daughters are the sons of distant men, right? Daughters, the daughter didn't contribute something to that child, or at least that contribution is not recognized. And you see it too. I mean, in You know, there's lots of ideas around there today that the child belongs to the father, is part of his heart and a piece of his body, right? No mention of mothers. And this is definitely detrimental to the status of women. I think it really stems from and reinforces the idea of women as inferior, as being unable to create, as providing matter rather than soul, and also as sort of disappearing into the identity of their husbands, not having an identity of their own, and again, just being kind of a vessel. And this can also inhibit a woman's ability to have access to her children in cases of death or divorce. So not across the board, you know, custody is often granted to women, but if children are seen as intrinsically belonging to their fathers, then men often win out in custody battles, right? Especially if there's a divorce and a woman remarries. But this was by no means everyone, by no means did all, you know, medieval Muslims subscribe to those views. Many Muslim thinkers believe that both men and women contributed something formative to the creation of a fetus, and they quote hadith to support it. And in some cases, the consequences of this recognition of bilateral descent are very tangible. So today, you know, recognition of bilateral descent gives women more custody rights over children, or allows them to transmit their citizenship or their nationality to their children. In pre-modern times, the consequences may have been less tangible. So if you have a son who is named for his mother, for example, which did happen and which is an indication of bilateral descent, you know, who knows how that woman is actually going to materially benefit. But I think that naming women definitely honors them and makes them visible rather than erasing them. And it kind of restores this reproductive or creative power to them that they might otherwise be lacking. So that's the idea of mothers, of motherhood, the idea that, you know, that mothers are actually related in important ways to their children. Another important way that bilateral descent can be recognized or ignored is through inheritance. So what a woman and her children materially inherit from her family of birth is a real indication of the degree to which they're seen as belonging to her family, the family of birth. So very strict patrilineal societies would cut women out of inheritance schemes entirely, right? And I'm talking in general terms here. I'm not talking about any particular Islamic society, but that's what would happen. They, you know, women would not inherit. A daughter basically ceases to exist after she marries, or she's a piece of property to be inherited rather than someone who can inherit. And naturally, her children, again, are not part of her birth family, so they wouldn't inherit from the birth family. So instead, in very, very patrilineal societies, you often have a very big emphasis on agnatic kin, right? The paternal grandfathers, paternal uncles, paternal nephews, paternal cousins, what's known as the asaba in Arabic. And again, this is something you have there's a lot of variety in. There's great flux in medieval Islam. So according to traditional narratives, pre-Islamic Arabia was very patrilineal. And when Islam came along, it introduced inheritance laws that put much less emphasis on patrilineality and patrilineal relatives, and much more on close kin, including daughters. So as we know, you know, the Quran allots inheritance shares to daughters. Apparently they couldn't inherit before. But then there's debate to what degree this was followed. To what degree were believers trying to shift things back to more patrilineal schemes? And one area where we see people trying to shift things back to patrilineality is through the creation of waqfs or endowments. This is setting aside a piece of property in perpetuity, usually, and an income from it can be used to benefit either a shrine or a mosque complex or a family or an individual. And very frequently, it seems that in the beginning, waqfs were created to deprive daughters of inheritances. So if a daughter is stipulated to receive a certain amount of inheritance, according to the Quran, and people did not want to dissolve or divide up a piece of property and give her some of it, because that would mean setting it apart from the lineage, then they would take the step of creating an endowment. So that would be inalienable in perpetuity. So it couldn't be touched. It wasn't subject to the regular inheritance laws. So while the person who owned the property was still alive, they would do this. Again, this seems to be why people started to create waqfs rather early on. But what's interesting and what I explore in my book is that later on, waqfs are used for the opposite reason, to actually benefit women. Because women, especially noble women, in places like Central Asia and Iran, would create them and they would name their descendants, both male and female, as beneficiaries. So women could become trustees or they could receive some of the income from the waqf. And all of this really helped to endow women with things that they might otherwise lack, right? Economic security, authority, prestige, and again, is linking her with her family of birth. So if a woman has access to money and property of her own that is somehow derived from her family of birth, it doesn't guarantee autonomy and a happy life, but it can't hurt, right? So that's another kind of benefit of recognition of bilateral descent. And the third manifestation of bilateral descent that I look at is succession. And this is probably the most important implication of the recognition of bilateral descent. So if a woman is not just a vessel for her offspring and her husband's identity, if she herself has an identity, something inherited from her birth family and something that she can pass along to her children, then it follows that she can manifest this identity potentially in the public sphere as well. And that's, that could be spiritual authority or scholarly ability or ruling capacity. And this is not all that common in either Islamic or non-Islamic pre-modern societies. Women, as we know, in pre-modern societies were generally seen as being inferior to men and unfit for operating in the public sphere, very irrational and very much ruled by their emotions. So there's a lot of treatises and tracts talking about these things. So there's a reluctance to, really have people acting as rulers or in other capacities. But exceptions do exist, and I do look at these exceptions. And this is what I found to be kind of the most openly agentic form of bilateral descent. So one thing I'm looking for in the book in the women that I'm studying is the degree to which they have agency, or that I can identify agency with them. And, sort of following Saba Mahmood's constructions of agency, I feel that there is agency that can be identified in the other forms of bilateral descent. But it's definitely more of a veiled form of agency. But this is, succession is the most kind of openly agentic form of bilateral descent. It's a woman having, not only the ability to govern herself and make decisions for herself, but to govern others. And this did occur, whether we're talking about the Fatimid Empire or contemporary Pakistan. And the consequences are huge. She's not a piece of property. She's an autonomous agent. She's able to control her own destiny, as well as potentially the destinies of others. So those are the three main ways that I look at sort of expressions of bilateral descent in the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You mentioned this in another answer just a second ago, but I want to ask it anyway in case some of our listeners are not too familiar with Fatima as and Muhammad's descent. So the subtitle of the book includes the words "The Legacy of Fatima," and she's obviously a very essential and recurring figure throughout. How is she relevant to the discussion of descent, or as you say in the book, a representative of bilateral descent?
Yeah, it's a good question. She's so central to this issue of bilateral descent in Islam because she's a very early and perhaps the most important example of it, and it's certainly the example that other people refer to quite a bit. So here's a bit of the narrative about this. So as we know, the Prophet had no surviving sons, and this led him, in the eyes of his enemies, to be seen as someone whose lineage was cut off because he had no sons. But traditionally, and when I'm talking about his enemies, I'm talking, of course, about the Quraysh, right? But traditionally, in both Sunni and Shi'i texts, he's not seen as cut off. His lineage is seen as continuing through his grandsons, Hassan and Hussein, with Fatima as a conduit. And this appears in Sunni texts, but it's necessarily kind of emphasized in Shi'i texts. And that's because, of course, Shi'is have a stake in seeing Hassan and Hussein as part of their maternal bloodline. So if Shi'is are saying that infallibility and Gnostic knowledge and religious authority passed down to Hassan and Hussein from their maternal grandfather, that they deserve to succeed him and their father as leader of the Muslim community, then they have to belong to his lineage. So particularly in Shi'i texts, we have all of the aspects of bilateral descent coming out with regard to Fatima and her son. So, we have so obviously there's the notion that comes out that Fatima's sons belong to her lineage and to that of her father. And this comes out in hadith, in Quran commentary, that actually call Hassan and Hussein the Prophet's sons, or in texts that talk about the Prophet's charisma and his Gnostic knowledge being transmitted in the form of light from him to Fatima and from her to her sons. It comes out in commentary that compares Fatima to Mary, the mother of Jesus, as depicted in the Quran, and talks about her ability to transmit her lineage to her sons, just as Mary transmitted her lineage to her sons. Many of the same texts also talk about how Fatima deserved to inherit from her father. Again, a very clear sign of bilateral descent. And they also talk about her in many ways as a successor to her father. Now, a lot of this was probably done for political reasons. As I mentioned, Shi'is were really invested in ensuring that Hassan and Hussein and their descendants were seen as the rightful inheritors of the caliphate. And to do that, they had to make sure that bilateral descent was seen as legitimate. And by no means was everybody unanimously agreeing that bilateral descent was legitimate. I mean, they had, they got into fierce arguments with the Abbasids, for example. But a kind of unintended consequence was that they, potentially unintended, maybe they did intend it. So this kind of consequence that occurred was that they really exalted Fatima and they gave her a very secure place in the lineage. So maybe all this was done for political reasons, but maybe not. But the end result was that Fatima ended up being very much exalted. You have a female occupying an extremely secure place in the lineage. And you have bilateral descent becoming kind of a notion. Again, scholars aren't talking about it in that term, but that is essentially what they're talking about. So that becomes something that that people refer to later on, and that affects how others view daughters in both Sunni and Shi'i societies. So, you know, for example, Amir Khosrow was Sunni, but he was affected by these views on Fatima. And in so many of the examples of bilateral descent, examples of inheritance or examples of succession that I looked at, Fatima was an inspiration.
So Maryam, the mother of Jesus, also figures very prominently throughout the book, and especially in the ways that particular women are remembered in history, right? So I was familiar with the parallels that are drawn between Fatima and Maryam. But then there are also parallels between Maryam and, say, Akbar the Great's mother. That was completely brand new to me. So to the point where miracles are attributed to someone like Fatima and Akbar's mother, especially with regards to chastity, like how they gave birth and everything.
Yes.
Can you tell us about which women get the status of being paralleled with Maryam and what specific ways they are reimagined like Maryam?
Yeah, sure. Another great question. I joke in the book that there's almost a cottage industry of comparisons of Fatima and Maryam. You know, it just seems like so many people have looked at this comparison. But you know, it's extremely prominent, and because she's quite frequently compared to Mary, and in some ways these comparisons are very natural. So Maryam is the most prominent female figure and the only named female figure in the Quran, as we know, and she's obviously regarded as extremely holy. So it's natural that people who are trying to exalt other female figures would compare them to her, right? And you know, of course, I'm looking at this from sort of the outsider's perspective, or the, you know, the academic, semi-cynical perspective. I mean, it's potentially, you know, from an insider's perspective, the comparisons are completely valid. I'm not saying they're not valid, but in the case of Fatima, there's this, you know, I just tend to look at what are the political reasons that people are doing these things. But in the case of Fatima, there's this added benefit to the comparison, because people who are trying to legitimize bilateral descent in the case of Hassan and Hussein could very easily say, well, Jesus is referred to in the Quran as Ibn Maryam, right? He's identified with his mother's lineage. He's thought to have descended from Abraham through his mother. So why can't you have the same thing with Hassan and Hussein and their mother? People made this very specific argument. You know, we see it particularly in the Shi'i Hadith collections. So this is a really useful means the comparison becomes very productive in that sense. But people made other comparisons too. And in some cases, trying to claim an even higher station for Fatima than for Mary. So if Mary was the queen of all women of her time, then Fatima was the queen of the women of her world and Mary's world and queen of women from the beginning to the end. So you have this kind of one-upsmanship that takes place, which may have been part of, you know, I don't know, one-upsmanship with Christians. And yes, many similar miracles are attributed to Fatima as the ones attributed to Mary, especially around the issues of chastity and purity. So like Mary, Fatima was considered a virgin, although here virginity was defined as never having menstruated rather than someone who never had intercourse. So she was never defiled by blood, and she supposedly gave birth from her thigh, right? So we have these miraculous births occurring, which are in many ways similar to the miraculous birth of Jesus. There are other miraculous births associated with other women who are compared to Mary. So there was a distant ancestor of the Emperor Akbar, and whose name was Alankua. She's this kind of semi-mythical princess who is supposed to have been impregnated by a ray of light, right? And she is often compared to Mary, as is Akbar's actual mother, who was named Mary or Mariam Mekoni. So comparing these women to Mary was a way of exalting them, of emphasizing their purity and their chastity and their kind of miraculous capacity, which if you're looking for legitimation, this is a way to kind of gain legitimation. And the question of chastity is, that's one that I really consider throughout the book. But for many of these women, their chastity is the reason that they're chosen to play these tremendous roles, right? And their chastity also bequeaths upon them tremendous power. So Fatima's chastity is supposed to have secured redemption for her children and possibly for their followers as well. And one other person who's compared to Mary is Parikhan Khanum, this 16th century Safavid princess who reigned briefly. And I think that in this case, the comparison was done to try to make a female ruler more palatable, right? So maybe there would have been more suspicion around a woman who was in the public sphere that maybe she would be unchaste. But by comparing her to Mary and by playing up the chastity and the purity that this association with Mary gave her, this was a way to get beyond that and potentially to make her more acceptable as a ruler.
So let's talk about Fadak, which I think is just one of the saddest moments in Islamic history. And in my opinion, although I think this is objective, an objective fact, one of the best examples of women's status going downhill immediately after Muhammad's death. So what is Fadak and why is it so important? What is the dispute and what are the Shia Sunni accounts on this? And
it's an incredibly complicated issue. And I agree it is very sad. Basically, both Sunni and Shi'i hadith collectors and historians like Tabari tell us about a piece of property named Fadak that had belonged to the Prophet. And it was an ancient oasis town about 2 or 3 days' journey from Medina. And its inhabitants produced things like dates and handicrafts that were valuable. And after the Prophet's death, there were a lot of arguments about to whom it and its revenue belonged. And Fatima claimed it. And she said, according to some accounts, that the Prophet had gifted it to her before he died. According to other accounts, she said that she rightfully inherited it as his daughter, according to Quranic inheritance laws. Now, a paternal uncle, Abbas, also claimed it. But Abu Bakr, the caliph at the time, said that it belonged to the caliphate and that its proceeds would be given to charity. And he quoted the Prophet saying that the children of prophets do not inherit. That hadith, by the way, is disputed. Fatima herself disputes that. But this caused a lot of conflict between Fatima and Abu Bakr. So Fatima herself reportedly gave a very big khutbah about it, in which she argued that Fadak had been given to her according to Quranic inheritance laws. And she also really strongly criticized the Muslim community for the direction that it was going in and for turning its back on the Book of God. And she was reportedly so angry at Abu Bakr about this that she did not she didn't speak to him until she died, which wasn't long after the Prophet. Now, some Sunni texts do say that he actually returned Fadak to her, and they play up the conflict a lot less. But even after her death, it continued to be a real bone of contention. So it changed hands a number of times over the centuries. It continued to be argued over between the Abbasids, descendants of Abbas, right, the prophet's paternal uncle, and Alids, or the Shiites, right? So there's this continued struggle between the proponents of a patrilineal and a bilateral scheme of descent. And it becomes a very visceral symbol of the caliphate itself, of Gnostic knowledge, of religious authority. So Fatima is implicitly claiming these things for Ali, for her sons and their descendants. And that's why I think she's became so interested in the fate of Fedak. And here is my cynical view once again, which, you know, may be wrong. I'm always looking at the political reasons. So I think that they weren't so interested in women's rights. They were concerned about showing that Hassan and Hussein and their descendants had the right to temporal and spiritual leadership, and Fatima's ability to inherit Fedak and to pass it on becomes symbolic of that. But in a way, that's very interesting to contemporary feminism. It becomes representative of a woman's right to inherit and of her children's right to inherit from the maternal line, right, from her family of birth. And this is what was being denied to Fatima. And the way that medieval Shi inheritance laws took shape really shows this. So Shi laws tend to be much more favorable to daughters and to their offspring than do Sunni laws, right? And less so to the asaba, right? The agnatic kin. So under certain circumstances, a daughter would inherit much more under Shi law than under Sunni. So for example, if a deceased person leaves a paternal grandfather, a wife, and a daughter, under Sunni law, the daughter would inherit substantially less than she would under Shi law, and the paternal grandfather is favored in the Sunni scheme. A daughter's son, under certain circumstances, would inherit much more under Shi law than Sunni. So if the deceased leaves a paternal uncle and a uterine brother, that's a brother from the same mother, and a daughter's son. So potentially the daughter's son would get nothing under Sunni law, but everything under Shi. So this is really claiming them as, the daughter's son as intrinsic parts of that birth family. And the jurists and the scholars who talked about these inheritance laws often referred back to the case of Fatima and Fedak. So I think that we could say that the example of Fatima and the way that Fedak, was taken away from her, people tried to take Fedak away from her, really helped to shape those laws.
I have so many questions about Fatima, but I don't know how much time we should. Because like you said, she's just one of. And you should know, this book actually revived my interest in her. I didn't even know I was that invested in her, and I was half angry the whole time that I was reading the book. But I learned so much from it, and one of those things was the idea that she had a mushaf of her own. That was just brand new information for me. What is going on here, and how well known is this notion?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating too. And to me, this is just another way in which she kind of appears in the light of a successor. So mushaf just means book or codex or a collection of sheets, and it's a term that's often used to refer to the Quran. But in Shi'ism, Fatima is also supposed to have received a mushaf. So this appears in hadith collection, right? So Gabriel, the angel Gabriel, is supposed to have visited her after her father's death to comfort her and to have told her about her father and his place and future events and what would happen to her children. And Ali was supposed to have written all this down. Now, there's some discrepancy over what is in the mushaf of Fatima. You know, obviously, we don't have it. But according to some traditions, it has legal rulings in it. According to others, it doesn't, but it does have marked similarities to the Quran in the way it's described. So it's supposed to have been a divinely inspired text, you know, again, delivered through the intermediary of Gabriel, and to have been imbued with extraordinary wisdom and powers. So according to one hadith, only the possessor of the Mus'haf has the authoritative, divinely inspired knowledge. So one of the imams, the sixth imam, Ja'far as-Sadiq, said that the book contains what makes people need us and makes us in need of no one. And it's been passed down from Fatima to the imams, right? So she is the source of it. I mean, ultimately, God is the source of it, but she's the one to whom this divine inspiration was initially given. And there are very kind of prophet-like similarities here, right? It's a text that bears similarities to the Quran. She, in receiving it, is similar to a prophet. So this is why I believe that it puts her in the category of a successor, right? Scholars are very careful to say that she's not a prophet, she's not an imam, but it does certainly put her in the category of a successor, I think. And I think it's fairly well known to Shi'is, maybe not too well known outside of Shi'ism, but I think it's fairly well known within Shi'ism.
It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
So let's talk about other female successors, maybe in the form of rulers or otherwise as succeeding their fathers or other male relatives to public or political positions. Who are some such women in pre-modern Islamic history, and how is their leadership received?
Yeah, so there are, I do want to note that it's not common. It was not common for medieval Muslim daughters to succeed their fathers to leadership positions, but it does happen. And so it does happen. And I look in the book at a few different cases of it. And I think that there are some commonalities that we can find among the different examples in which it occurs, including the fact that, of course, these are dynastic societies where leadership is associated with a particular family, which possesses a particular charisma that qualifies them to rule. So women are frequently seen as enjoying that that charisma too. And under certain circumstances, as maybe when there's not a fit male relative, women can be seen as able to rule. And they can manifest these qualities that are not typically associated with women. Things like good sense and reason and judgment and military expertise, all these things that women aren't supposed to have. So it might happen only briefly. It might happen only when there's not a fit male. There might be a lot of constraints, but it does happen. So we see it with the Fatimid Empire, for example, with the princess Sitt al-Mulk. So her father, the Caliph al-Aziz, supposedly thought very highly of her. He asked her opinion on matters of state. So you see a lot of these people being educated, being brought into the court, being consulted. After he died, her brother, Sitt al-Mulk's brother, the Caliph al-Hakim, also consulted with her. After he disappeared under kind of mysterious circumstances, she ruled briefly during an interregnal period. And then after that, when her nephew was nominally ruling, she was really the ruler, right? And this is something that historians of the time attest to. We see it also with the Safavid Empire, with Parikhan Khanum, the princess that I mentioned earlier. She was an extremely bright woman. Again, this is a case where her father, Shah Tahmasp, regarded her very highly and kind of cultivated her and consulted her on many decisions. As with Sitt al-Mulk, Parikhan Khanum's brothers succeeded her father, but she likewise ruled briefly during an interregnal period. Now, with both Sitt al-Mulk and Parikhan Khanum, there's lots of intrigue. There's kind of messy stuff that occurs between them and their brothers and their followers, and they get drawn into or maybe create a lot of intrigue. Parikhan Khanum was actually executed at the order of one of her brother's wives when she was just 29. So they didn't always have the happiest endings. But these were things that happened to anyone, right? Men and women. So it's maybe kind of par for the course. The point is that they were able to be really major players on the political stage as a result of these dynastic connections and this kind of transmission of charisma. One more example is the Delhi Sultanate in India, a woman named Razia, who ruled for almost 4 years in the 13th century. And she's her example is really interesting. She was apparently appointed by her father. So her father, Sultan Iltutmish, supposedly recognized her very strong capacity for ruling, and he designated her as his successor over his sons and over the objections of his advisors. And she did rule, again, for almost 4 years. And again, this is it's really interesting because when her rule began, she had to be secluded as a woman, but it's difficult to rule from seclusion. You can't ride out among the people. You know, you can't do the things that you need to do as a ruler. So in order to kind of deal with these constraints, she decided basically not to be a woman, and she began to dress as a man. So she essentially became a man as ruler. She went out, she rode elephants among the people, she led armies. And this is a really, you know, striking idea for us now, I think, you know, particularly at this juncture now when the issue of gender ambiguity is so much a part of life. But what it shows to me is that the boundaries between the genders were not as kind of impermeable and fixed as we may think them. You know, so women could essentially become men, right? They could transcend their gender. And although she was very hotly criticized for it later, at the time, it doesn't seem to have caused much of a tumult. And that's another thing I found interesting is that a lot of historians who are contemporary with these rulers and are looking at their rules are speaking about them in kind of matter-of-fact ways, right? Not as though it was a huge deal and also praising them. So, you know, it seems as though it wasn't the most outlandish thing in the world to have a woman ruling, you know, especially when you have these dynastic connections. And again, many of them were both encouraged and cultivated by their fathers.
Right. That was really fascinating too. Basically, if I can't be respected as a leader because I'm a woman, then I'll just not be a woman.
Exactly.
Right. Is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners about your research or this book?
I do want to, you know, I did want to note about Fatima that, you know, I spoke kind of briefly about her khutbah.
I can't believe I didn't ask a question on her.
That's okay. I mentioned it briefly. But I think that, to me, you know, she's depicted in a multiplicity of ways. But she's often depicted, I think the traditional way of looking at her is as of this kind of very shy, quiet, you know, unassuming individual who kind of preferred to fade into the background, someone who tried to hide away from public view, was very worried about being seen by the eyes of men. You know, if she was going to have leadership and authority, if she was going to be a successor, it was going to be in the next world, not in this world, you know. And in the next world, she does have a lot of, you know, incredible powers of intercession and so on. But really, in her khutbah, you know, I think she really, you know, comes out as a successor there because she is, you know, she's extremely critical of the direction that the Ummah is taking, right? As I mentioned already, she's kind of pointing people in the right direction. She's portraying herself as the daughter of a warner, which is investing herself with authority. And this is also how it's been received, right? Both in pre-modern and modern times. So pre-modern Shi'i hadith collectors actually quote Fatima's khutbah in the same way that they quote the imams, right? So here she's not a transmitter of hadith. She's a source of hadith. So to me, that's very meaningful. And there are some contemporary Shi'i scholars who look at what she did and stood for, and they say that she has infallibility like the imams do, that she was, you know, the first to point out the corruption of the ruling party, and that she really is a model for behavior, just as the prophet and the imams were. So this to me is really kind of signals, is kind of pointing in the direction of her as a successor, even though, you know, I don't agree with those scholars who say that she was actually like the rightful leader of the caliphate rather than Ali. But I think that, you know, we do see these signs and indications that she, that in some ways she was seen as a successor and as, you know, as one who could act in the public sphere in a temporal way rather than, you know, just having spiritual authority.
No, her sermon definitely, I mean, and I get that there's a dispute about how much of the sermon actually is hers and how much of it, you know, people added on later to it. But
yes,
both the Sunni and the Shia'i accounts do at least acknowledge that she gave some kind of a speech at the mosque and she's criticizing Abu Bakr. And it's a very, I feel like just that stand alone is a very, very powerful illustration of her knowledgeability, her outspokenness, her desire for justice. But that's not necessarily how she's often depicted. And you, I really enjoyed the section also in the book where you talk about, where you point out that she's not necessarily often depicted as a figure of authority. But then there are moments where scholars do acknowledge, you know, they well quote from her speech and as though the way that they do the imams as well. So thank you for pointing that out. I definitely did mean to ask a question.
Oh, no problem at all. No problem at all.
So before we close, we like to hear what our authors are currently working on. Are you working on any projects? Assuming you are, because we're in the middle of the pandemic, for God's sake.
I have been able to work on a few things here and there, thank God. And you know, I recently finished up a couple of articles that had been on the back burner for a long time, and it was really good to work on things that were short. So one of them is actually an offshoot from this book that didn't make it into the book. It's an examination of Hind bint Utba, the mother of Muawiyah, the caliph, right, and how his identification, Muawiyah's identification as Ibn Hind, right, which he was sometimes called, son of Hind, how that represents bilateral descent, but not in a good way, right? In a bad way. So I have a brief article which looks at that. Another project is an article about the story of the prince Siavash in the Shahnameh by Ferdowsi, and how he represents a sort of supranational ethos. So those are two things that I just kind of finished up. But the next big project ahead of me is in some ways a return to my roots. So Amir Khosrow, the person who started all of this, wrote several divans of poetry. And he wrote autobiographical prefaces to all of them. And one of these prefaces to the divan known as Qurat al-Kamal is very long and detailed and contains a lot of historical and literary information, including literary criticism. So I'm coming up with a critical edition of it and other prefaces for Murti Classical Library of India. And I'm translating them as well. And this is really exciting for me. I've kind of gotten away from working intensively with Persian texts, and I've missed it. It's also exciting because Amir Khosrow led such a colorful life, and you know, it's very cool to get to follow him along on his adventures. On the other hand, it's very challenging because he filled his writing with puns. You know, he never met a pun that he didn't like, and trying to replicate that in translation is just daunting. Mm-hmm. So this is the big task ahead of me in the next project that I will be turning to soon, inshallah.
Right. No, that's some very exciting stuff. Looking forward to it.
Oh, thank you.
So this would be all for our interview. Thank you so much for your time and for your book. I have no doubt that our readers, our viewers will also enjoy it very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
So that was my conversation with Alyssa Gabay on her wonderful book, Gender and Succession in Medieval and Early Modern Islam, Bilateral Descent and the Legacy of Fatima, published in 2020. Thank you for listening, and I will see you again soon.